Blog Talk Radio.
Pleasure to have you here. Thanks for coming back. We'll try and plug in some useful and enlightening bits of information. It's an interesting time of year. This is the 200 and what did it would be? 64th day of the year. Remarkable. We've made it this far. The world seems to be, do you notice that the news, it's kind of funny, the news is every day that we're teetering on the edge of something. Usually news is embellishing, making things more sensational than they are. It's a tragedy when things are very important and already sensational. To sort out what is the seriousness of what's going on, because everybody seems to feel it's all right to play with the truth, play with history. Oh my goodness, yes, I know. Whose truth? Well, the common man has a sense of that we call common sense. The common sense approach seems to exist around the world. And even with qualifiers, we can determine the truth. And that's what we need. Over and over, we teeter on the edge of the apocalypse, according to headlines. And my computer didn't stop when the clock turned to 2000. Bad things have happened. Idiots and zealots cause all kinds of mayhem, always for the cause of their version of good. But they cause a lot of destruction. That's not exactly news. It's like car accidents happen. That's not exactly news. It's news when it happens to a member of my family or your family. But that's personal. That's not something that's sensational. We have endorsed a great deal of hypocrisy in the world for the sake of what? The advances of communication? Well, communication didn't come with a rule book that said this is how you follow it. This is what you do to avoid making fools of yourselves. It just crept up on us from the print to the printed page. Word of mouth, yelling and hollering across the valley for each other. Come on over and have a visit. Signaling to each other, hey, there's some strangers coming and we're not sure what they're up to. So keep your heads up and keep your wits about you. To what we have today where, a few of us noticed that you can read all the fine print, and some people do. And they seem to get quite agitated about it, including members of our order. Seem to get quite because we experience this wave of opinion, and you're left to your own devices to sort out the fact from the opinion. Facts are the truths, aren't they? And as we know, the truth will set you free. The rest is fine print. So if you're wary of it, and the world hasn't become a worse or better place. It is what it's always been. It's a challenge to live as it should be. We have these, as we spend more time on the planet, we are able to make observations. And if we're dependent on the training of the people around us for our outlook on life, then we're often, many of us are left with this sense of bleakness. And we cover it up with a notion of indifference. Or hubris, the divisions that seem to give a social status really quite transparent when you think about it. So there we have an amazing day has occurred in spite of all of the nonsense and silliness that's going on in the press, and it will. Do we? This isn't a program about the impending nature of the impact of mankind. We're a curious lot, and we should always keep that in mind. We're interesting, and we're basically around the world nice people. So the rest, the divisions in language and the way we comb our hair or the way we dress really doesn't matter that much. We'll all become fashion critics. We'll eventually, we live together long enough, we eventually rub off on each other and somebody kicks a ball around and somebody else kicks a ball around and we have a match and then we get together and we have a good time and a meal. And we're not very complicated people, but we still all have our grumpy buggers that sit in the background brooding and carrying on. And every so often we need to give them a bit of a kick, have a bit of a kick at them and tell them to smarten up and shut up. We need to let everyone know you keep your idiots in line and we'll do the same. And every so often when ours get out of line, I hope we'll apologize. And when yours get out of line, I hope you'll apologize. But in the meantime, we're not going to take them serious because the idiots never, ever amount to much. No, they can cause a lot of mayhem. But at the end of the day, they're just idiots. So I'm going to talk to you about some things Masonic. I've got some interesting programming going on today, I think, and some interesting music. This is, though, I want to remind people around this part of the world about a really interesting event. The fire on a ship in Toronto Harbor. And this will only take me a second, so bear with me. It was on the SS Neuronic had been launched on the 2nd of June in 1913 in Port Arthur. You know where that is. And and she was a passenger and package freight to a ship on the Great Lakes. Five decks, 362 feet long, and 6,095 gross tons. So, she could hold 600 people and a crew. She had 200 crew. So here, tell you the little story that happened. And Neuronic had two sister ships, the Huronic, which is built in 1902, and the Harmonic. And the Harmonic burned in 1945, and Huronic was retired and scrapped in 1950. So it's within memory of some really, really old people, I suppose. On the 14th of September, which happens to be today. Back in 1949, the Neuronic embarked on a 7-day pleasure cruise, Lake Ontario, from Detroit, Michigan. And the ship was to make 2 overnight stops in Canada before returning to Detroit. Most of the 524 people on board were Americans, and 171 crew members were there as well. The captain of this particular voyage was Captain William Taylor. So on the Neuronic docked for the night at Pier 9 in Toronto Harbor on Friday, September 16th. And at 2:30 a.m., a passenger named Don Church noticed some smoke coming from the starboard corridor on C deck. And this had 5 decks. And he followed the smell of the smoke to a small room, and just forward of the women's washroom, and the smoke was coming out of a locked linen closet. So he went and found a bellboy named Ernest O'Neill. And without sounding the alarm, O'Neill ran to the steward's office and got the keys to the closet. And so he opened the closet door. The fire, with all the oxygen, you know what happened, exploded into the hallway. And it quickly spread. And it was fueled by the lemon oil polished wood panels. You can imagine back in the day. So O'Neill and another bellboy and another passenger tried to fight the blaze with fire extinguishers, but the flames really spread more quickly, and they had to O'Neill ran to the ship's fire hoses, and they weren't working. So Church rushed to his stateroom on D deck, right, and he got his wife and children and fled the ship. They were at dock. Now, O'Neill ran to the officer's quarters and notified Captain Taylor, and the first mate, Jerry Wood, then sounded the ship's whistle to raise the alarm. It was 2:38, so that was 8 minutes after they first realized that there was a puff of smoke in the air, 8 minutes after the fire began, and already half of the ship's decks were on fire. There was a 27-year-old named Donald Williamson, who was the first rescuer on the scene. And he had been working a late shift at the Goodyear tire plant. The former Lake freighter deckhand wanted to just see the Neuronic, which he knew was in port. So when he arrived, the ship's distress whistle was already going on. And as the fire was spreading really quickly and people were jumping into the lake, and he spotted a large painter's raft nearby, and he untied it and pushed it into a position near the ship's port bow. And as people were jumped off the ship, he was pulling them from the water onto the raft. And there was a routine call put out to police, Constables Ronald Anderson and Warren Shattuck. And they turned their accident car onto Queens Quay in time just to see the ship erupt into flames as high as the mast. Their cruiser was immediately surrounded by survivors, many of them in shock, and some of them were on fire. A passenger alerted Constable Anderson to those in the water and those in the deck. Some were in flames. He stripped off his uniform and jumped into the cold water. It was covered with oil. And he began to assist Williamson on the raft. Detective Cyril Cole joined them, swimming for survivors and bodies to the dock. Other police arrived and began hauling up the injured by rope, and others were giving first aid. Fireboats were there. Others were jumping into the water from the ship. One of those officers was a fellow named Jack Marks. He went on to become Toronto's police chief. The crew had to smash portals to drag some passengers out of their cabins. Moments before the whistle sounded, the pier's night watchman noticed flames coming from the ship and called the Toronto Fire Department. A pumper truck, a hose wagon, a high-pressure truck, an aerial truck, a wet rescue squad, the deputy chief and a fireboat were dispatched. Ambulance and police were dispatched. The first fire truck arrived at the pier at 2:41. They were going as fast as they can, but the whole ship was in flames. Crew members had failed to make a sweep of the upper 4 decks to wake passengers. And those who did wake were awakened by screaming and running in the corridors. Most of the ship's stairwells were on fire. Few of the passengers were able to reach E-deck to escape down the gangplanks. Some passengers climbed down ropes to the pier. People that later described the scene as pure panic. People were jumping from the upper decks engulfed in flames, some falling to their deaths onto the pier below. Others were trampled to death in the mad rush. Some were suffocated, some were burned alive, unable to exit their cabins. They said the screams of the dying were said to overpower even the sounds of whistles and sirens. The first rescue ladder was extended to B deck. It was immediately rushed by passengers, causing the ladder to snap in two. Women were sent tumbling into the harbor where they were rescued by a waiting boat. After about 20 minutes, the metal hull was white hot. The decks began to buckle and collapse into each other. After an hour fighting the blaze, the Neuronic was so full of water from fire hoses that it listed severely toward the pier, causing firefighters just to pull back. But the ship then righted itself, and the firefighters went back and continued to fight it. By the end, they said there was more than 1.7 million gallons of water poured into it from 37 hoses. These fighters were desperate to put this out. 5 a.m., they finally stopped the fire. The wreckage cooled for another 2 hours before they could recover bodies. It was never really determined how many people died. Glass had melted in every window, and even steel fittings had warped and twisted. Somewhere between 118 and 139 people died. They either suffocated or died from burns, or being trampled or leaping off the decks onto the pier. Only one person drowned. And to the anger of many common people, all of the people who died were passengers. Not a member of the crew died. The death toll was blamed largely on the ineptitude and cowardice of the crew. Too few crew were on duty at the time of the fire, and none attempted to wake the passengers. Many of the crew fled the ship at the first alarm, and no member of the crew ever called the fire department. Passengers had never been informed of evacuation routes or procedures. Captain Taylor was hailed as a hero. He was among the last of the crew to leave the Neuronic. During the fire, he broke windows and pulled passengers from the room, carried an unconscious woman down a smoke-filled passageway, and lowered her by rope to rescuers. But despite his courage, his license was suspended for a year. The ship settled to the bottom, and it was shallow there. And it was eventually taken apart. The upper decks were cut away and the hull was refloated on the 29th of November, 1949. It was towed to Hamilton and then scrapped. Company officials suspected arson. Comparison was later made to the fire aboard the Canada Steamship Line's passenger ship Quebec. Fire proven to be deliberately set in a linen closet on the 14th of August, 1950. Damages settled for the Neuronic at just over $2 million. The Neuronic's whistle is now displayed in a nautical museum on Toronto's waterfront. So now you know, this day, a brave people, eh? Interested in a little, that's some little nautical nostalgia because, this country has couple of million lakes. We have 18, the Great Lakes have 18% of the fresh water of the entire world. We have the longest coastline of any country in the world. We are surrounded by three oceans. Three. So we have a connection with the oceans that we can't escape. Many, for generations, many came from other countries to escape, to search for opportunity, landing at the docks in Halifax, crossing the ocean by ship. A daunting challenge for the most stout visitor. And still it goes on. So I want to talk to you a little bit today about chasing a biff from the lodge, as I put it. I don't think I'm being... Am I known for being pedantic? Maybe a touch. Maybe a touch. Bear with me. Come with me. Jump down the rabbit hole together. Freemasonry dances on the head of a pin. But this pin is already crowded with great thinkers, and it's deafened by the silence. That sentence took me a couple of hours to... It just sort of came to me. A thoughtful Freemason might think it would be wise to search out the instruction to brethren, if such a thing ever did exist. What instruction? And the thoughtful Mason would be right. Speaking to us from the past are pages describing manners to follow in various common interaction. We call them the ancient charges. The thoughtful Freemason might be forgiven for noticing they contain a practical description of dignified behavior that would solve the ill-mannered behaviors that men have brought into Freemasonry. Yeah, Freemasonry doesn't include ill-mannered behaviors. We do. Always have. Would we criticize him for noticing that poor stewardship draws out the worst instincts of human nature? I don't know. We might all but isolate him for thinking that Masons ignoring the lessons fractures our order into rough and polished. In life, authority becomes overbearing when accountability is lacking. But authority becomes entrenched when men abandon their responsibility to resolve disputes. If men cannot even discuss opposing ideas without becoming emotional or even resentful, we are lost. This is fertile ground for repeated and avoidable appeal to authority. We are alike, you and me. All peoples are alike, descended from the same stock, partakers of the same nature. But we live in a world where people are not all equal. Some are brighter than others, some more observant than others, and some more articulate. The biff is that the best of us all, the one that can carry himself with grace and poise. Good manners teach us what to do in unpredictable and uncomfortable situations. When we are taught manners, and when we self-taught or otherwise, we know what to do, to handle ourselves with grace. I fear that many of us have been raised in families or been influenced by people who use any excuse for coarse language and thoughtlessness, as if when something unexpected and rough happens around us, that is justification for us to do the same. That's just bad manners. no matter whether it came from family or friends or our own imagination. Oh, I've been wronged, therefore I have an excuse. Somebody used an ill word, an uncomfortable word around me, therefore I have an excuse. What's the excuse for you to define your nature in terms of the coarseness of life around? What's your excuse? And is that all you've got? Is that all you've got? You know you're capable of more. You know Abiff is capable of more. He points it out for us. He doesn't brag. There's no hubris. He shows us about sacrifice. So somebody does you wrong. You don't know how to walk away. You don't know how to control your emotions. What are we, little boys? Time to grow up, wouldn't you say? A mature mind maintains his perspective, maintains his balance, and relies on good manners. So be a victim of circumstance. Allow your life to be absolutely controlled by the behavior of others that we often will translate into something that is simply a thinly veiled excuse to enable us to be foolish and thoughtless. Except take a look in the mirror when you're doing it. Really think that you can justify it, do you? Well, I suggest this to you. The number of times that a man can justify coarseness in life, in his entire life, would be less than the fingers of one hand. The rest is uncontrolled emotion. So I think it's time that we tried to bring Abiff back into the lodge. And this is a prescription that I suggest for all of us. It's a prescription. It relies in the ancient charges. The study, not the reading. The absorption, understanding. I mean, let me be the one that it tells you or explains that the purpose of the charges is just that, how to conduct ourselves. So, three of us are meeting on a street, and the fourth is not a Mason. When we walk away from each other, would that fellow have any inkling that we are Masons, or would he know us as good-spirited fellows? You and I know the answer to that. My goodness, I've even seen fools flashing a sign in public. Yep. I don't think that that's news. But when we see these types of shenanigans, we can move away. Keep the company of Masons who respect the principles and respect the protocols and the history. Our history are the charges. If you haven't read them, shame on you. If you have no sense of what they mean, shame on you. You're the student. You're the one that picked up the tools and said you wanted to be part of something that could make you better than you are, don't come yelling at me. I didn't make this stuff up. It's all there, all around us. It's true, eh? Want a little help with this? Think of the beauty. Think of the beauty of what's going on around us. There are so many things that are we are allowed or encouraged. The arts and sciences, well, open your minds. Open your minds. We're all in this together. Every last sod. We've got some crazy buggers running around today, just like we always have. We're going to have to go and do something about them because they're causing all kinds of mayhem. As soon as, you know, there's always a group that can convince themselves that they have to go and make life really, they have to go and scare people and hurt a lot of people in order to make themselves seem powerful. And all through history, every single time, the rest of us will get up and go and shoo them away. Well, that's happening now, unfortunately. You'd think that we would learn, but this is the uncultured nature of man that we don't control. We don't wrestle out to the answers. We make incredible assumptions. Let's listen to a little bit of what would influence our brethren in the day, 19th century. This is an Italian composer who wrote some opera in a very, what's referred to as a romantic style, very melodic. And he developed his, he became one of the leading exponents of something called the Verissimo. This guy is born in Tuscany in 1858. It's six brothers and sisters, yeah. and he wrote some incredibly beautiful music. Here's a little piece. This is called O Mio Bambino Caro. It's not very long, but Giacomo Puccini. So delicate, so beautiful. nice way to start a conversation over things Masonic, isn't it? I think so. Hope you can see what Puccini was trying to do. He was born on the same day that, not the same year, but the same day that my wife and I were married, the 22nd of December. He was born in 1858. And he lived well into, he died November 29th of 1924. So some of the later day Masons would have heard his music. I keep losing track of the big influences, the big composers, like who came first, who came second. I know that Haydn was born on the 31st of March in 1732, so a lot of our boys would have, a lot of the order would have been listening to his music, Papa Haydn, as he was known. And then Mozart was born on the 27th of January of 1756. And he was influenced by Haydn, of course. Where do you, you know, you're a genius. And after him, Beethoven, I'm not sure when Beethoven was born. I know his first performance was on the 3rd of November of 1778. Here's a nice little story. He was listening to, Mozart was sitting, he was fairly young at the time, he was sitting in the audience listening to Beethoven. And afterwards, he was talking, he said, it was very nice, but where's the spark? And Beethoven said to him, give me a melody. And so Mozart gave him a melody. And Beethoven produced what later became the Third Symphony. And yes, Mozart was impressed. Who wouldn't be? Even the wags that say that, you know, Beethoven couldn't finish an idea. His ideas are beyond description. Ideas beyond description. So when we're putting together our list of the great minds of the time, we think about the scientists, we think about the merchants, we think about the military. That's only been because of the limits of communication. Hildegard de Bingen, yes, of course, a great spiritual, esoteric thinker of her time, what, medieval, 13th century, 12th. Do we think about the arts? Well, we sure do. Because it's not a battle that defines not a general that defines our culture. It's what hangs on the walls, you know. It's how we portray ourselves. The cave drawings from a tapestry to paintings. Carvings, sculpture that convey who was here before us. And we often, if we have any intelligence at all, revel in the capability, the mastery of the technology that they had and the connection, reminding us we are all partakers of the same nature, huh? We aspire. So what do we see? The hunt. And then we see the jewelry, the adornments. Anyway, how about a little bit of something Masonic, just to whet our appetite? Don't be like that, but Jeannie just gives a nice little mindset, I think, yeah? I think so. I've been wanting to talk a bit more about this for a long time. We seem to go in fits and spurts. Or at least I do, I guess. I'm sorry. I go in fits and spurts. I was thinking a lot about the Essenes and the Mithraeans some time ago, a couple of years ago. And then I sort of, you know, it seemed to become dull to me. I wanted to move on to other things. The the context of the craft is changing because now we're just as we are in our public lives, we are awash in opinion. How often have you heard people talk about Masonic education? I'd be hard pressed if you were to put it to me what the world that is. I understand learning and I understand a mind, a willing student or not, but are we talking about a matter of opinion? No fact? Well, my goodness. Talk about, wouldn't that make us all a bit delusional or self-serving? If I only read about the opinions of written by Masons, how do I sort out what's fact and what's fiction? Every opinion is valid to the person holding that opinion, but some of them are based on premises that make little sense. And some of them seem to play very loose with the facts. I don't think that our order, our philosophy, exists without proofs. Somebody, a couple of people, twice in the course of my time as a Freemason, have referred to philosophy as bullshit. And I tend to think a lot of, and these were, I don't respect either one of them. One was fairly, thought a lot of his rank, that it carried a lot of rank, but in that moment, it revealed his nature to me. The philosophy contains proofs, and those proofs may change over time, but nevertheless, if you can't distinguish that from opinion, then you're really not speaking in philosophical terms. And again, just because I can't follow it doesn't mean that it's not valid. But we need to be able to tie in consistencies into our thinking. So how often do we have to be reminded? The charges, in one hand, and the ancient landmarks in the other. The consistencies are the landmarks. When I look at and think about Freemasonry today, I shake my head. How could something so clever come out of an order that is defined by the Masons of today? The cleverness of not defining the landmarks. I've heard fellows in earnest. There are 9 landmarks. There are 7 landmarks. There are 44 landmarks. All with proofs. And all very forceful and serious-minded about it. Well, if you have 5 landmarks in mind and they mean a great deal to you, and they have a defining character to you, then you have that many landmarks. But what about what of the next brother who has 20 landmarks? Is he wrong? Is more better? Come on. Is there one truth? Well, let's knock on the door of the Delphi Oracle and ask. What are the abundant and essential truths? Know thyself. Huh. So the landmarks you hold in mind are essential and valid. If you're a thoughtful person, if you're emotionally mature. If you're simply mouthing the words of some other man, well, then that's all that you're doing. There's no examination in that. But it is a start. We all start like that. We all start like that. So when we see somebody doing that, no need to be smug. We were there once. We all had to learn how to tie our shoes one day. We all had to learn how to pull up our trousers and how to ride a bicycle, how to hold a pencil, how to do arithmetic. Anybody out there claiming they were born with all of that? A little genius, yeah? So remember, that Mason that we search for, when you see him, do you recognize him? The fellow living within his means, quietly going about his business. You remember the charge that teaches us that? The one that we sort of sigh and makes us very reflective. The one that we know is talking about a Biff. Here's a Biff. He's the best of us all. And this is how a Biff lives. Can you and I come close to that? Well, every single day. Perfection is hard to live with. It's insufferable. But striving to improve, it's wonderful. It's influential. When you choose your Masonic company, make sure you're choosing people that are able to influence you in a good way. Choose wisely. Choose people that can draw on the best aspects of your character and help you to develop them. And pass that knowledge on to other people. The rest, the rough and the coarse, they have their own work to do. Yeah, they're God's creatures. The Essenes. Speaking of creatures that were wonderful and interesting. This is a really disputed part of Masonic history, isn't it? But we can trace these Essenes. These were a very ancient Jewish sect. So we know a bit about them. And we know that this was a movement that existed around the 2nd century B.C. and the 1st century A.D. So very, very long, would you say? Most of what is known of the Essenes and their beliefs comes from the accounts of the contemporary historian Josephus. Josephus tells us that there were three main Jewish sects, the Essenes, the Sadducees, and the Pharisees. Now, some out there have said that, you know, Dead Sea Scrolls were written by the Essenes, but the term is thought to apply to a number of Jewish groups who shared similar ideas and practices, but which how they had different ideas on points of religious belief. It's been argued that there are numerous similarities between Masonic practices and what is known of those of the Essenes. Well, so there would be, we'll say, the same about David Hume, the Scottish philosopher and economist, won't we? Oh, yeah. We'll get around to that in a minute. If we're going to make these kind of claims. The Sadducees and the Pharisees were born into their communities, but the Essenes were created membership through individuals being invited to join. Yeah, selection. Today, our selection is a little dodgy. Come on. Our notion or do we strive for it? We have so much political baggage that we're just in these little dust storms when this topic comes up. We bring our own mindset into it. We're not ascribing or aspiring to the philosophies and the defining elements of Freemasonry. We're bringing baggage. But there are similarities. It appears that the same community had different stages or levels of membership, and entry required vows of secrecy. And breaching these promises would carry terrible punishments. Our punishment has been this collective erosion. Well, you can't touch me. If I say something that leaks out one of the secrets, then I'm immune to you. I'm immune to that collective judgment. But I contribute, every time that happens, we contribute to the erosion of the credibility of the craft. How can we monitor? How can we hold ourselves accountable? What terrible punishment. We've had braggarts, malcontents, throwing open what they consider the secrets of the order to the world. And so we go a little deeper, and we tell even them, that's not the secrets. You've seen something, you've experienced something that's sacred to a lot of people, and you have a callous attitude toward it. You have no honor, you've given an oath, and you've broken your oath. You're without honor, you're without dignity, and you're without the trust of a lot of very sincere and dedicated men, striving to live up to their obligations and their oaths. The candidates of the craft take vows to join the order, and we're warned about, you know, punishments if we should break those promises. But we're also told that the punishments are symbolic. That's the way they should be. We can't go around harming people. Who amongst us is going to judge? Really? You see how carefully we examine issues within the order. When somebody has to be disciplined, it's so carefully done, so delicately done. Parallels have been observed between what is known in the ancient mystery religion of Mithraism and Freemasonry. And for some, the hint is they hint that there's a link. Again, it's a stretch. Worship of the god Mithras, in one form or another, seems to have gone back about 3,500 years, spanning cultures. So keep your heads up here, boys. You'll see some things that you can wire back to 3,500 years ago. Now, if we're going to lay claim, then we would have to, this is like suggesting that then lay claim to a connection with the ancient Arab scholars, because they developed and created the mathematics that we use today. Lay claim. Come on. The cult of Mithras became prevalent in the Western Roman Empire about 67 BC. And we know a lot about Rome, but it eventually fell a couple of centuries later. It was argued that early Christianity and the cult of Mithras had a surprisingly large number of features in common. Christianity, it could have become Mithrasian, yeah. Both religions feature gods born on the 25th of December who offer salvation through faith, knowledge, and compassion. Both involve the sacrament in which wine is served to symbolize sacrificial blood, and during a ceremonial meal, small loaves of bread marked with a cross were eaten, symbolizing sacrificial flesh. Mithrasian referred to one another as brothers and were ministered to by a leader called Father. Although little is known about the theological structure and beliefs of Mithraism, It has been speculated on the basis of written sources and surviving archaeological material that its initiates passed through seven stages or degrees. Betrayism and Freemasonry then feature the concept of its members passing through stages of development. They have also been served as secret societies in which special knowledge is limited to certain key individuals within the group. Both groups aimed fundamentally at men. Many of those who joined the cult of Mithras were drawn from the upper echelons of Roman society, including the emperors Commodus and Trajan. Freemasonry, certainly in Britain, has exhibited a similar tendency to recruit its members from the aristocracy and nobility. Now, boys, that ship has sailed. Come on. Now, anybody with a pulse. Yeah? Not to say that the talent is still not coming through the door, but we all know what's happened with the recruitment, the blatant recruitment. These field days where you become 3 degrees in a day. Freemasonry, certainly in Britain, had that. Mithraism was compatible with the old religions of Rome and Greece, where it incorporated, and it had brought those views into its worldview. Freemasonry never claims to be a religion and embraces a wide variety of faiths. But it sees its purpose as spiritual development of the individual within his own personal cultural beliefs. It can therefore be relevant to any number of different religions. Both Mithraism and Freemasonry have also stressed the importance of high moral standards in their members. Although Mithras had an established class of priests who administered to the needs of its members, that was not like us at all, not like Freemasons. Freemasonry is about the development, the self-learning that goes on when a man realizes that if he's going to progress and know certain things in life, he's going to need to develop his own interest and take on the responsibility for doing that himself. Yeah. Wonder what inspires these great composers over time? What inspires them to become writers and librettists, and when they're thinking about these noble themes, is it that they study constantly, or they're taught the classics, and then out of the classics, we know that there are these phenomenal stories. You think about it. We've just learned about the neurotic. There's a tragedy. Well, a composer would be able to convey the energy, the tragedy of that event to audiences. What would the composer be talking about the crew abandoning their positions, the nobility of the captain fighting on to the very end, the conspiracy of this being a fire that was deliberately set. Yeah, I think it would make an interesting story, but I don't have that kind of a talent. This fellow did. This is Giuseppe Fortino Francesca Verdi. He was born on the, just after me, he's a Libra. He's born on the 9th of October, 1813. And he just loved opera. But if you're like the crowd that influenced him, Bellini, Donizetti, Rossini, by all means, get into their work. We'll talk about the influences and the testimonies of people that were part of that creative genius at the time. Verdi was the fellow that wrote the Grand March. Do you remember? You see the opera that has all of the animals, the elephants and horses and camels and giraffes in it. That's Aida. That's a story about an Egyptian period. Fascinating. I actually had an opportunity to see that on a huge scale in Toronto many, many years ago. That must be back in the 70s, I would think. It's just absolutely staggering. Just staggering. Here's a little piece, just a little taste of what Verdi was capable of doing. Check this out. It's only a short little piece. Yeah. You've heard this. This is from Rigoletto.
Musa d'accento e di pensiero, sempre amabile, leggiadro rito, il fiato il rito e menzognero. La donna è morte, quasi un malvento, musa d'accento e di pensiero. E sempre dietro sia il cattivo, sia continua, al campo il cuore, ormai non sentati, felice appieno, fin su quel seno, dall'iva ore, Madonna e morte, quasi un maledetto, muta
bar, a pub, public house, singing for the barmaids. He was the Duke of Mantua. There you go. What's not to like? I don't know. I was born the son of a farmer. How much distance is there between a fiddle jig in Prince Edward Island and Verdi's opera? Oh, one generation. Me. Man, I still like a fiddle jig. I'm going to wrap this up. We've got a little bit of music. You know, one fellow that wrote deliberate music for Freemasonry is a fellow that it's so easy to mention him, Mozart, the German. He was very young, very, very talented, and he died broke. Yeah, broke, destitute. It's just amazing. But he gave us perspective like this. This is from Epictetus. When you are offended by any man's fault, turn to yourself and study your own failings. Then you will forget your anger. Really, what he's saying here is use it as it's a waste. It's a waste to be that offense. The energy and what it does to us emotionally is an unproductive waste. But to use that anytime we find ourselves offended, you know, how dare you, you know, that kind of thing. Use it as a trigger, as that button to examine your own failings, our own failings. And keep in mind that when we do that, we'll forget our anger. But when we examine our own failings, we also have an opportunity to begin to control them. We have two ears and one mouth so that we can listen twice as much as we speak, says Epictetus. Lovely man. Lovely, lovely man. The key is to keep company only with people who uplift you, whose presence calls forth your best. I changed the wording a little bit earlier, but you get the point. There is only one way to happiness, and that is to cease worrying about things which are beyond the power of our will. And here, embrace this close to your heart. Wealth consists not of having great possessions, but in having few wants. There you go. We press on. As Epictetus tells us, only the educated are free. Let's make that important in emphasizing the free and free reason. It has long been a favorite notion that to the Rosicrucians of 1614 and Bacon's New Atlantis, the Freemasons are mainly indebted for many portions of their modern rituals. This comes from the Freemasonry in Canada. Fred, you took in parts of this before. There is certainly much more to be said in support of this view than in regards to the connections with the Knights Templar. The New Atlantis is probably the key to the modern rituals of Freemasonry. To whom we owe modern Freemasonry of 3 degrees is a much controverted question. Brother Huguen gives the credit to Drs. De Sellier and Anderson. I would be one of those people, not because I'm of that cut, but what those fellows were doing makes some sense. The transactions at the inauguration of the Premier Grand Lodge in London in 1770 were not, unfortunately, duly recorded at the time, and hence the Book of Constitutions, which came out in 1723, and the earliest minutes of the Grand Lodge with Anderson's account of the meeting in the second edition in 1738 are practically all we have to guide us. 4 old lodges for certain, and probably more, took part in the proceedings of that eventful gathering. And from that body so formed has sprung directly or indirectly every Grand Lodge of free and accepted Masons, working 3 degrees in the universe. These lodges originated, we don't know, but some of them possibly during the 17th century, 1600s. There were several other old lodges working in their own prescriptive right in England during the second decade of the 18th century. though they took no part in the new organization at first. Of these, one in particular may be noted, which assembled at Alnwick from an early date and whose preserved rules and records begin in 1701 through 1703. Its regulations of 1701 are considered valuable. It's a copy of the old charges and is still treasured. The Grand Lodge was also petitioned to constitute a regularize many lodges in London and in the country, but as these all took date from their recognition, we know little of their previous character. The one in York, like its fellow in Alnwick, never joined the new body, but preferred independence, even if it involved isolation. The records of this old lodge exist from the year 1712, but a roll from 1705 was noted in the inventory of 1779. When it was inaugurated, it's impossible to say, but it may be a descendant of the lodge which we know was active at York Minster in the 14th century. The York Brethren started a Grand Lodge of all England in 1725 and kept it alive for some 20 years. After a short interval, it was revived and in 1761 and continued to work until 1792 when it collapsed. Prior to this date, several subordinates were chartered. The Grand Lodge of Ireland in Dublin was formed in 1728, but there was one held previously at Cork. The Grand Lodge of Munster, as early as 1725. The Scottish Brethren did not follow the example set by England until 1736, and then managed to secure Brother William Sinclair of Roslyn as their Grand Master, whose ancestors by deeds of AD 1600 to 1628 had been patrons of the craft, but never Grand Masters, though that distinction is long claimed as hereditary in that Masonic family. From these three Grand Lodges in Great Britain and Ireland have sprung the thousands of lodges throughout the world. Through their agency, and particularly that of the military lodges of the 18th century, the craft has been planted far and wide. Though there is evidence to prove that brethren assembled in America and probably elsewhere in lodges prior to the formation of either of these Grand Lodges, or quite apart from such influences in Philadelphia in 1731, or earlier in New Hampshire. The latter apparently having their manuscript copy of the old charges. Nothing has ever been discovered which connects such meetings with the workings of the historic 3 degrees of early 18th century origin. Some 7 years after the Premier Grand Lodge was launched, authorities to constitute lodges were issued for Bath and other towns, and a few later for abroad, especially through the medium of provincial Grand Masters first appointed in 1725 as Boston, Massachusetts, in the year 1733, to which provincial Grand Lodge Canadian Freemasonry owes its birth. They did remember us. Next time we come back, we'll talk about the Grand Lodge of Canada in Ontario. Yeah. This is a little piece written by George Bennett. He's Grand Chapters of the past Grand Scribe Ezra of the Grand Chapter of the Royal Archmasonry of Canada. And he took his work from a précis by John Ross Robertson, past Grand Master of the Grand Lodge of Canada in Ontario. So we'll get into that. That's kind of interesting. You're going to hear a lot of back and forth now about Hopoof, 1717, 300 years. There's a lot of politic and posturing that goes on in Britain that, we have our own version of it over here in North America, but this will be, trying to deal with the the provenance. For a long time, we've heard 1717. Now we're up to an anniversary, and we realize when you start to examine this, it frays a little bit at the edge, doesn't it? better to take the high ground and say, no, that wasn't the start, than to be have fingers pointed at you and say, what are you claiming here? That's not true. And the light, let's say the boys in England will likely embrace an enlightened view. 1717 is what it is. It's the start of something, of governance. But as you've heard me talk about so many times, governance has very, very little to do with the principles of true Freemasonry. That's that's the part that requires the self-discipline that you bring. Your commitment to follow through with your obligations and your vows. Not the rank, not the authority, not the permissions of any Grand Lodge. That's the essence of Freemasonry, is within the confines of your mind, the true temple. So here, listen to a little bit of the music of Freemasonry. Haydn and Mozart wrote some of this stuff, and I want to get out of here now. This is just a little piece. This is called Freemason Music, and this is by a guy. He put this up on the internet. So here's what he has to say. If you do anything, any of you have done anything on the internet, Bill Masonic, you'll know why he's done this. There's a lot of very strange folks out there that just troll the internet looking for us. He says, due to the overwhelming number of conspirationists, cretins, roaming about, I have chosen to moderate all future comments. If you came here to vilify Freemasonry, Freemasons, Mozart, etc., kindly sod off. Thank you. Freemason music.
Oh, man.
serious-minded stuff. I hope you have enjoyed the program today. You you can find yourself back to a lodge around you real soon. Treat yourself very kindly. You are a thoughtful and contemplative man, and it's a pleasure to have you join me. I look forward to having you back again soon. In the meantime, commit those acts of random Masonic kindness. Who's going to know?